This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franson. We at the Local Talk team decided the best way to start 2019 was to explore our hopes as the year begins. Our first guest was just elected to her office, so we expected her to give us a fresh look at county government. What we heard was more serious than we expected. So I'm here with Linda Merkin, our supervisor-elect. We're talking about our hopes for 2019, and I bet you have a few hopes. Is that right, Linda?
Well, Susan, I certainly do. And when you contacted me and asked me to come and talk with you about this, I didn't have to think very long about what I wanted to talk about, because I recently read a book. And can I plug a book?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. It's Storm Lake by Art Cullen. And as you know, he recently won the Pulitzer Prize, and then somebody said he should write a book. So he did. He wrote a book about Storm Lake, what it's like now, and what the surrounding Iowa land is like. And he's been there, I think, all his life. So he had a perspective about the land. And I found it very interesting. And I want to read a quote that he did from Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac. Aldo Leopold, the great conservation philosopher, said, "We end, I think, at what might be called the standard paradox of the 20th century. Our tools are better than we are and grow better, faster than we do. They suffice to crack the atom, to command the tides, but they do not suffice for the oldest task in human history, to live on a piece of land without spoiling it." And he quoted that because he thought it was still true, even, I don't know if you can say more true, because you're true or not, but more nearly true now. And Sand County Almanac was published in 1949. That's the year I was born. So I'm thinking Aldo Leopold said this the year I was born. Art Cullen wrote Storm Lake in 2018, and he didn't see any difference. He probably saw things that were worse. So after that and him quoting Leopold, I thought, well, I've got a copy of Sand County Almanac right there over on the dresser that I haven't picked up for a long time. So, and I remember a friend of mine saying everything about conservation was in the last chapter of Sand County Almanac, which is called The Land Ethic. And what Leopold says in that, and I know this is circular and roundabout, but you'll see. What Leopold says in this, there are three different kinds of ethics that he sees. One is an ethics about how individuals treat each other. The second, and that's well developed. The second ethic is about how individuals treat society and vice versa. And that's also well developed. The third is how we treat the land. And he says, we do not have a land ethic. Our land ethic is simply about using the land for our own personal benefit, not respecting the land, not respecting the other species besides humans that live on it. You know, we see this a lot in Iowa. 98% of the land in Iowa has been cultivated or paved over or developed. We are the most developed state in the nation. We have 750 impaired waterways. We lose our topsoil to the Gulf of Mexico, which does a lot of damage there, as well as losing our productive land. And we lost our native prairies to the plow a long time ago, and now we're losing our ag land to development rapidly. And the other thing is, the Union of Concerned Scientists have said we have 1.5 degrees Celsius more to go in terms of warming until we're past the point of no return. So you put this all together, and what's the most urgent thing that we need to work on? It is obviously that we need to work to reverse the degradation of our planet. There's a group called Climate Justice Movement right now. And I attended a meeting last fall because they were talking about local government. And I saw that was an issue. I thought, well, I'm running for county supervisor. Maybe I should figure out what this group is about and what they're looking at. But I came out of the meeting with two things. One is that the people who suffer from climate change are the people who are least able to take care of themselves or to deal with it, you know, and that's probably third world nations. But more importantly here, and to the point locally, is that this group was saying we need to start with local government. we need to make the changes here at home. And for a long time, local governments said, we can't do anything. We need to wait for the feds. We need to wait for some other level of government. Well, that's not happening. So this group is really talking about what local government can do. I don't have all their recommendations or know what all is going to come out of it, but I know that they're going to be very active. It was a sense I got in terms of talking both with city government and county government in terms of what we need to do at a local level to help reverse climate change and the degrading of our environment. And so I feel like I'm bookend between Sand County Almanac in 1949 and Storm Lake in 2018 right now, because what Colin's saying is it's not gotten better. It's gotten, you know, it's gotten worse. So that's during my lifetime. But the other thing I saw with Colin's book that I was really, really excited about, I think it's chapter 14, which is where he really talks about the impacts of agriculture and development, all the things that we're doing to the land. He quotes a lot of experts, and I saw lots of names that were very familiar because they're people who work over at Iowa State University or who have retired from Iowa State University and are still here. And you know what? We have tons of expertise here locally. So I think that we are situated in a great place to take advantage of that expertise, to take advantage of new people in government, to take advantage even of some planning that I found out was done 20 years ago that never really went anywhere, you know, to look at what can local government do to make a difference. And we have to do that. And I am hopeful. After reading both those books, I'm hopeful that we can. Even though you can come back, you can come out of it and say, oh, that's really depressing where we are as a state. But the thing I liked about both Leopold and Cullen is they were able in their books to convey, let me say, a love of the land and how the land is very special. And I just hope that more people think about that. I really hope more people read both of those books because that's the motivation. We need the motivation that people feel like something, land is something more to just plunk a house down on or to plant fence row to fence row with row crops and get as much money out of as we can while corn is still a good price, or if it isn't, you know, then plant more so we get more, so whatever. We've got to look at doing it differently. And I think if we can really help people appreciate the land we live on, they'll have more of an investment. You have any questions?
Yes. You're going to be a county supervisor. What do you think the county supervisors can do about this?
Well, I served on the Planning and Zoning Commission for the last 3 years, the County Planning and Zoning Commission. And we looked at some things there that just in terms of development that we thought made some sense. Some of the commission members were concerned about development and the impacts of traffic. So we asked the staff to put together an ordinance that would require a traffic impact study when there are major developments that happen out in the county. I think that what that helps do is have more orderly development. And that's really important, you know, if we're looking at ag land being converted. And we're going to have more of that because Story County is growing and Ames is growing. That's going to continue happening. We know that. But we need to do it in an orderly, planned fashion. The other thing I think we need to look at is what the impacts of development on water quality. Story County spent some time and some money in doing watershed assessments. We have some very nice studies, some very nice reports, and some recommendations. It's time for us, and we do have staff working on this. We have a working committee of staff. It's time for us to get there and implement them. We have a lot of information. We need to use it. We need to implement it so that we are mitigating or reducing the impacts of development of agriculture on our waterways.
And it sounds like that you and your other commissioners are in a good position to make a difference.
I think we really are. I think the time is right. I am also really looking forward to seeing what our local climate action team comes up with its recommendations, because we do need their help. I hope they, and I think they do have some people from Iowa State involved, some people with some expertise here, which is really good. We've got to take advantage of the expertise we have at Iowa State. We've got to take advantage of the expertise we have in our community. You know, county government can't do it all. We have a great workforce. You know, we have great staff in the county, but we don't have all the expertise there to solve all of the problems of Story County. But working together, we can do it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio. For the first program of 2019, we have asked several people what their hopes are for this year. Our first guest was Linda Merkin, Story County Supervisor-elect, who reflected on her concerns about our land and water.
Today in the KHOI studios, Dr. Irv Kloss, a representative of the wildlife community. But how would you describe for our listeners, and when I mentioned the wildlife, the co-op unit with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was under your leadership for many years, and I knew you best from that.
Well, I retired 18 years ago, Pat, and I was 30 years as a professional wildlife biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And I volunteered the year after I retired to run for Soil and Water District Commissioner. And since then, I have been involved with agriculture and soil and water and water quality particularly. But I also became interested in climate, and so that's where I'm focusing my efforts today, my energy. And it's been a very big awakening for me, I guess you'd say.
Awakening in what regard? Current political process or with?
Well, one of the things that I kept reading in the wildlife literature was that a species extinction was happening. In fact, we had being called the sixth great extinction. We've had a number of episodes in our long, long millions of years of history in this planet that extinction was brought about by natural causes. But today, extinction of species is being brought about by humans, and it's not natural. It's caused by humans.
And this topic of climate change, where would you have placed its origin in your life, Dr. Kloss?
Well, it started soon after I retired, I guess. A group of us at the Unitarian Fellowship here in Ames decided to form a little discussion group, which we called the Skadberg's Circle, which was named after Marvin Skadberg, who passed away shortly after we got started, but he was one of the instigators of it. So I guess we started talking about climate change soon after that discussion group was formed, and we had Fritz Franson, who was retired physical chemist from Iowa State, and Sam Wormley, who was from the Ames Lab, and they were very knowledgeable about climate.
Yes, they
from
are.
The standpoint of chemistry, of how physics and chemistry could be used to explain what was happening. And so I learned a great deal from those guys in those discussions that we had for almost a decade, actually more than a decade. So that's kind of where I started. And then during that, I read James Hansen's book, Storms of My Grandchildren.
Let's talk about Dr. Hansen just briefly for our listeners. I believe he grew up in Denison, Iowa.
Yeah, that's right. He was born and raised in Denison, and he was lucky enough to go to the University of Iowa and study physics under Van Allen. And he must have been a very bright guy because Van Allen noticed him and offered him a graduate assistantship to start studying.
And Dr. Van Allen, probably the most premier distinguished
scientist. The Van Allen radiation belt around the Earth is named after him.
Yeah.
And he was one of the pioneers of atmospheric science.
But, so James Hansen was one of his.
Yes, and Hansen's topic for his doctorate dissertation was the atmosphere of Venus. And at that time, they didn't know what was causing Venus. They knew from measurements of light and so on from that planet that it was a high temperature. It had over 800 degrees Fahrenheit. But they didn't know the cause of it. So Hansen's was helped by actually a space mission by the Russians that determined that the atmosphere of Venus consisted of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide and and sulfuric acid, things like that.
On the level that Earth is being
subjected
to.
And so Hansen was interested in that aspect of Venus. And then he became interested, after he went to work for NASA as a space scientist, that he became interested in the Earth. And he was actually told or asked to form a mission to Venus to study that atmosphere more carefully. And in the middle of that, he gave the project over to someone else in order to study Earth. And so in the 1970s, he started studying the Earth's atmosphere. He was a reticent scientist as far as politics were concerned, but he published a paper in 1981 in a very reputable scientific journal. It was noticed by people like Al Gore, who was then in the Senate. And Al Gore asked him in 1989, I believe it was, to come to Washington and tell a Senate committee about what he felt was happening to the Earth. And he did that, and he got a lot of publicity out of it for a while. But then he went back to his lab. He says, I didn't want to be in the public view. He went back to the lab until after 2000. And at that point, the government was changed hands and George Bush became president. And he was asked to brief the president's cabinet on climate change. And so he did, but he was given 20 minutes to his presentation. And on the same day, the same group of people that was brought in, there was a science denier. And he said, I could see right from there that he was not going to be listened to, that the science denier was going to be carry the day. And so he went back to his lab, and he kept studying, and eventually wrote this book, The Storms of My Grandchildren, in which he explained very carefully and very, I thought, explicitly what is happening. Mm-hmm. And reading that book changed my life. In that book, he said that he did not want his grandchildren to grow up knowing that he was called Opa. That was the word for grandpa. Oh, and he says, I didn't want my children to say Opa knew what was happening but did not make it clear. Mm-hmm. And so he spent the rest of his life, he's in retirement now, but he is spending his time trying to teach people about the great peril that we are in. Mm-hmm. And I guess I take my inspiration from him.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I am Susan Franzen, your host for today, as we start the new year 2019 by speaking to a variety of citizens of different ages and backgrounds about their hopes for the coming year. Surprisingly, those we spoke with all raised an issue that many people have been reluctant to talk about publicly until recently, climate change. Our next guest is several decades younger than those you just heard from.
Hello, I'm Lucas Bliley. I'm a high school student at Ames High.
You've been in here before to record. What did you record here at KHOI?
So I've done a variety of things. In the past, I read my book on air, The Scavengers, on the community bookshelf. I was part of the election guidebook for young voters, 3 or 4 episodes of that. And I also came in a couple other times for the Fort Kids and also to reflect on the election of 2016, the morning after.
Okay. Well, this is a different kind of morning after. This is the first day of 2019, and we're talking to people about their hopes for the year. So that's where we'll start with you.
Some of my hopes for this year are to start to see some of the climate action I envision happening. And I'm pretty hopeful. So I'm thinking on an individual level, there's a lot of stuff that people can be doing. People can decide as a New Year's resolution that they can carpool more, that they can eat less meat is a huge one, less red meat especially, that they can stop buying from companies that are polluting the environment. And there's a lot of that with the fashion industry. So moving away from fast fashion and towards more ethical brands. So all these things are small individual choices, but I'd like to see them happen on a larger scale. And I think it's for a lot of them, it's a win-win situation. If you're buying fast fashion clothing, you're not getting high-quality clothing. If you're eating a lot of meat, that has health impacts. If you're not carpooling, you might be getting somewhere a little faster, but you're not having that time to talk to your friends or talk to somebody you maybe don't know that well and create that relationship. So those are some of the individual things. But as a town this year, I also hope that we do a few things. The first is the city council voted on October 16th to discuss the prioritization of climate change. And so once they establish that, we will know where the city stands, and then we can start working on something. And I hope to see that in the form of a climate action plan where we are taking an inventory, and the city council also is looking into taking an inventory of all the carbon emissions for the city. So getting that done and then starting to create a plan for how Ames can transition away from fossil fuels. And I'd like to see 100% renewables by 2050, as the IPCC report said is what is needed.
You're just one individual high school student. How do your peers feel?
So actually, that's interesting that you ask. So earlier this month, we did a petition that we're going to take to the city council and to the school board. And this petition was through a group called CAUSE, which is a high school club, and it stands for Citizens Actualizing and Understanding Sustainable Environments. Kind of a mouthful, but it makes a nice acronym, CAUSE. And so we did just a week-long drive where we were asking students to sign, and we got 613 signatures. And they were signing that, yes, they think climate change is a problem, that it's man-made, and that the city and the school have some role to play in finding solutions.
So, and you stopped the petition after just a week.
Well, we were actually kind of burning out. We were going around asking people, and just were like, okay, after a week, we got 613. Like, maybe we could get more, but 613, that's a huge amount. And I think that'll have the impact we desire, which is just to show that, yes, we're, as students, we care about this issue. Are we able to, you know, solve global warming? No. But are we able to convince our local officials that we should be reducing emissions and maybe thinking about some other solutions? And that message was conveyed.
Well, on a personal level with your classmates, are you finding that they are gravitating toward your other solutions, for example, carpooling, not eating so much meat, so forth?
Yeah, I've seen a trend with some people. And I think the people who are really motivated to do something are the people who have looked into like how dire the situation is. And I think for those people, climate change is less of like a political issue as like an existential crisis. When you are growing up, you have all these hopes and dreams. And the biggest thing standing in the way of that is we might not have a habitable planet in 200 years if we continue what we're doing. We won't. In 50 years, we will have a planet with a lot more war and famine and climate refugees. And that's the future. You know, like that's what we have to look forward to. That really weighs on somebody. I sort of gave up my passion of creative writing because, well, I gravitated away from creative writing because I didn't think that was going to be impactful enough. If I'm just writing fiction, which is what I like to do, and living in my own little world, like that's great. But that's not what the world needs. And so just that's an illustration of how I don't feel like I really have a choice with my future. I think I have some obligation to do something about this.
Do you have anything else that you'd like to say?
I want to make sure I'm vocalizing the fear of young people the best I can, because I've seen this. People are really scared, and it's kind of disguised behind this business as usual. We go to school every single day. We all talk about our college plans and where we would hope to go, and we're all talking about the careers we hope to have. But kind of in the background of that is this reality that, I mean, we're talking by 2050, we're going to start seeing some of these effects that are really disastrous. I mean, we're still going to be working and trying to have a normal life, but it's not guaranteed like it was guaranteed some past generations. The only thing I can think that's somewhat similar is like the threat of like nuclear war during the Cold War. That was like either it happened or it didn't. This is like this inevitable thing on the horizon that keeps coming. And then year after year, we see, you know, more apathy towards dealing with it, more countries not taking responsibility for like their part. The U.S. is probably the biggest example of that.
This is KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM, and questions about hopes for the future have led us to the topic of climate change, a topic some people think is too scary or controversial to talk about seriously. In this half of the program, you heard from Linda Merkin, County Supervisor-elect, Irv Kloss, retired wildlife biologist, and Lucas Bliley, student at Ames High School.
Scientists have to believe in the facts that we generate and we produce. You have to have some faith in that, right?
Right, yeah.
And so Catherine Hayhoe is an atmospheric scientist. She has a PhD in that field, but she's also calls herself a devout evangelistic Christian. In fact, she's married to a minister in an evangelical Christian church.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, she believes that what she studies and what she learns about the climate does not contradict what she believes as a Christian. Because if you believe in a supreme being that created this earth, then humans are putting that creation in danger. And so we have to work together to overcome that, and that's what she is saying. And I think that is a very clear message to the to people of faith who want to believe those things. So it's not inconsistent with Christian thinking. And many churches now have social action committees that are dealing with the effects of climate because the effects of climate is really endangering and hurting people at the margins of life right now, right, margins of our society. Yeah. And people who live in low-lying areas and get run out of their homes by flooding or severe fires like is happening in the West, those bring to mind that we have a social action obligation to do something about. I've been drawn attention to an organization that's just sprung up called Climate Mobilization. And what they're saying is that we need to mobilize to fight the climate war.
Now, is this in Iowa or is it part of a national network?
This one is a U.S.-based organization, but there are similar ones in Australia and Europe that are having people engaged. In fact, it's really would be great if our federal government would take the leadership and mobilize this country. But actually, this administration, the president and the Congress that we have now, have abandoned their role to protect people from the effects of climate. And so it must start at the grassroots level. It must start at the local level. A man by the name of Philip Sutton in Australia, he's a scientist, by the way, and he has made the thesis that we must mobilize at the local level. And he sees that there are really two critical purposes for getting local councils to declare a climate emergency. And first of all, he sees us creating what he calls a campaigning beachhead from which to get the nation and the world to declare a climate emergency. So that if a number of cities would join together and declare an emergency and begin to form a climate action plan, that would be the necessary action to solve the problem as an emergency. And broadly, there's a societal commitment to fully adequate climate goals and commensurate follow-on action. So if you make a declaration of an emergency, then you should have a plan to do something about that emergency. And he sees that happening. And by the way, Climate Mobilization has only been in existence about 3 years now. And it was started by a woman who has a doctorate in psychology by the name of Margaret Klein Solomon is her last name, Margaret Klein Solomon. And she was interested from the standpoint of a psychological thing. How do we convince people that there is an emergency and they need to take action? And so she started this organization called the Climate Mobilization. And they have been able to convince the cities of Hoboken, New Jersey, Montgomery County, Maryland, Los Angeles, California, Richmond, California, Berkeley, and Oakland to declare states of emergency and to develop climate action plans. And there, several of them have declared that they will become carbon neutral, which means that they will restrict carbon emissions, that is, carbon dioxide emissions, within 10 years.
Well, what's it going to take to implement these procedures here in Ames, Iowa?
October 16th City Council meeting, I think, was kind of a pivotal night for Ames, because that was the night they decided to discuss prioritization of climate change. And also on that agenda that night was approving the contract for a comprehensive plan for Ames, and they were contracting that to RDG, I think. And part of that was David Martin asking the contractor, what are you going to do about climate change? And for the first time, I felt like an adult in my life with some position of power, you know, was standing up for the climate just by asking that question. And that was like an emotional moment for me, because up to that point, I'd felt let down. You know, as a kid, I knew about climate change. I was thinking about climate change at like the age of 9. Like, that was just something I was thinking about, and it was weighing on me. But I was like, okay, the adults will fix it. The adults will fix it. But year after year, that proved to not be the case. It was proven that, like, I guess I was going to have to, you know, step up and do something. There's a lot of great people out there doing a lot, but it never feels like enough. And so I think a lot of students are overwhelmed by that. And then for me, I'm like, I don't feel like I have any choice but to do something about it. When people say, oh, it's so great that you're passionate about climate change, I'm like, no, I know. It's not a hobby. It's not something that I enjoy immensely. It's something that I feel like I have no other choice. And I think there's other people who also feel like that. And I don't think I'm the only one. Young people.
If today's conversations have inspired you to learn more or to become involved, there is a series of programs at the Ames Public Library entitled Climate Crisis, Facts and Action. Gather with community members for a light meal, then learn from experts not only why the climate is in crisis, but different ways we can mobilize to reduce greenhouse emissions and sequester carbon. The food will be at 6:15 p.m., and the programs will begin at 6:30 p.m. The first is Wednesday, 16th of January, 2019. Learn the science behind climate change and why you should care. The facilitator will be Irv Kloss, ISU Professor Emeritus of Animal Ecology. And the second is on Monday, the 25th of February, 2019. The subject is Using the Courts to Kickstart Climate Action. Can Children Show Us a Direct Path Forward? The facilitator for this is Channing Dutton, Attorney Channing Dutton of Lawyer Dutton and Drake, LLP. Channing Dutton is also an active member of Citizens Climate Lobby in Des Moines. The next is on Wednesday, 27th of March, 2019, Saving Iowa's Soil, Climate Change and Agriculture. Facilitator Jerry Hatfield of the USDA Agriculture and Environment Laboratory. And finally, on Sunday, 14th of April, 2019, Ames Reads Leopold. Join guest readers as we read aloud the writings of Aldo Leopold, widely acknowledged as the father of wildlife conservation in America. His most famous work, A Sand County Almanac, published in 1949, is still popular with naturalists and writers alike and is applicable to many environmental issues faced today.
I've been weighed down by sadness like a stone. We have yearned, we have yearned. We have sometimes felt so utterly alone. While we turn, while we turn, we've been stricken by the wonder of it all. Stricken down, stricken down. We have sometimes felt so faint we want to fall. Overcome. Say this year in flight together has been fun. What say we make one more circle round the sun? We have been weighed down by sadness like a stone. We have yearned. We have yearned. We have sometimes felt so utterly alone. While we turn, while we turn, we've been stricken by the wonder of it all. Stricken down, stricken down. We have sometimes felt so faint we want to fall. Overcome, but all in all, I'd say this year in flight together has been fun. What say we make one more circle round the sun? Thank you.
The other thing that I'm hopeful about, this is covered a lot in a book called A Climate of Hope, and it's by Michael Bloomberg and Carl Pope. And Michael Bloomberg is considering running in 2020. He's a former Republican, but he would be running under the Democratic ticket, and he would be pushing action against climate change. I always have to clarify that. But his stance on it is that business, cities, and communities are what are going to lead the fight against climate change. It's not going to be countries agreeing, because as we've seen at the last COP24, some, you know, optional things. But what he was saying is that cities have a vested interest in getting rid of coal-fired power plants because they pollute the air, they cause health problems, they cause asthma problems. And those are real tangible things that people can see, that if their community switches to solar, you know, it's much cheaper than coal. It's competing to be cheaper than natural gas. Since that's now a reality and cities have that option now, we're going to see them switch, because nobody wants a dirty coal-fired power plant when there's this other option. And of course, they have to supplement it with something because, you know, the sun doesn't shine all the time and they've got to do some other innovative things, but they're willing to do it. And there's a town in Texas, Georgetown, Texas, that just switched to 100% renewables. But the last two elections, I think in 2016 and in 2012, they were a completely Republican county. They voted for Trump and they voted for Romney. But they're still super on board for renewable energies because it makes more sense. They were able to sign contracts where they had a price guarantee for 25 years. But with coal, natural gas, you can't do that because it fluctuates all the time. And I look at the U.S., which with the journalists being killed in Turkey, you know, and Saudi Arabia being to blame, we couldn't do anything about it because we're tied to them for oil. You know, if we switch to renewable energies on a large scale, that frees us up as a country to pursue whatever our actual genuine interests are. And we don't have to worry about, are we going to make Saudi Arabia mad? Are we going to make these other oil-rich countries mad? And I see that as a great future. So A Climate of Hope is not that unrealistic if we start the shift now in a big way and we take advantage of the technology we have. So I've been increasingly hopeful, with even just in the last couple of months, that something big is going to happen, and not because concerned with protecting the planet just because the planet is good. It's going to be because it's going to make money. It's going to make people money to switch to renewables. And I think that's kind of a sad truth, but I'm excited that we're at a point where the technology is there so that that's a possibility. And I think we're going to see that.
As we wind up our program on hopes for the future of this year, 2019, Pat Schlarbaum brings us a phenology about the ring-necked pheasant, a favorite of everyone.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. The first cicada of summer or the last flock of barn swallows in autumn are noted in a journal for future reference and comparisons from year to year. And as Lee Searles of Marshalltown writes, phenology is the study of natural cycles in the lives of living animals and plants. And today's phenology is about ring-necked pheasants. From its lofty perch upon the brush pile, the pheasant's tail feathers drape nearly to the ground. The bird seemed regal, glowing in the early morning sun. He cast his eye warily toward our stopped vehicle on the road, then dropped away into the prairie. Then additional movement. A fast-moving hen streaked from the brush pile into an opening before the taller grasses swallowed her movement. Then another and another and another until eight were counted, almost as kids in the schoolyard playing follow the leader. It was the Christmas bird count for the local Big Bluestem Ottoman Club, and the pheasant's showing was decidedly improved from previous years. The ring-necked pheasant, a bird native to China, is by far the most successful introduced game species in Iowa. Ringnecks were first brought to North America in the 1700s, and in 1881, 28 birds from Shanghai, China, were released in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. The birds thrived, so many game farms were established in the nation, including one run by William Benton at Cedar Falls, Iowa. It was believed the ring-necked cousin, the prairie chicken, would not return, and the non-native ring-necked pheasant was better suited to the agricultural landscape of Iowa. And in 1900, a windstorm blew down the fence confining the birds at Benton's farm, and about 2,000 birds escaped. This seems to have been the first introduction of pheasants to Iowa. As the birds became established through other rearing and releasing projects, pheasant numbers began to increase. Iowa began charging hunters a license fee. The state set up its own game farm at the state fairgrounds in Des Moines in 1913 and later at the Wildlife Research Station by Ledges State Park in Boone County in 1938. Thousands of pheasants were raised and released where adequate grassland habitat existed. Yet a new perspective on pheasants emerged. Maybe it is better to ensure habitat is flourishing and expanding, as opposed to putting pheasants grown at a game farm and taking pheasants from the wilds. Put and take conservation practices were replaced with creating suitable grassland habitat. Ensuring the landscape has adequate habitat to rear young to replenish the mortality is much more holistic. And grassland habitat that provides for pheasants helps out all the other grassland birds like meadowlarks and bobolinks, and the mammals like meadow voles and badgers. These birds also occupy an impressive range of habitats. In Hawaii, for example, they can be found from sea level to 11,000 feet in elevation. They can live in forests, grasslands, and deserts. Despite their versatility, ringneck pheasants do gravitate to particular kinds of habitat for specific activities. For early season, they seek cover along grassy roadsides and fence lines and ditches and wetlands. And as the spring season progresses and vegetation grows taller and denser, they shift to their nesting activity with fields of hay, particularly alfalfa. Typically, they roost in trees or dense shrubs in spring and summer and in forested wetlands, farm fields, and weedy areas in fall and winter. Ringneck pheasants eat seeds, especially grain, from farm fields as well as grasses, leaves, roots, wild fruits, and nuts and insects. Their spring and summer diet is similar, but with a greater emphasis on animal prey and fresh greenery. They eat insects, such as grasshoppers, beetles, caterpillars, crickets, and ants, as well as snails and earthworms. Pheasants take most of their food from the ground, scratching or digging with their bills. They can retrieve roots or seeds from as deep as 3 inches below the soil surface. They also sometimes forage in shrubs or trees for fruit, leaves, and buds. Clearly, the ringneck pheasant is well established as a game bird in Iowa. With some help from stocking efforts in the early 20th century, pheasants have gradually expanded their range so that now they occupy virtually the entire state. In Iowa, there are over 100 Pheasant Forever chapters as non-governmental conservation organizations. And since its inception in 1985, the Story County, Iowa Pheasants Forever chapter has raised over $2 million for grassland habitat. And each year, over $60 million is added to our Iowa economy by pheasant hunters pursuing their ringneck prey. Rather than pheasant population diminishing due to hunters removing a portion of the adult rooster male pheasants, their population is governed by habitat, specifically habitat that provides for overwintering cover and dry springs. Surveys have shown that warm, dry weather in spring are essential. Ringneck pheasants originated and evolved in the dry steppes region of China. Indeed, spring weather with minimal cold, wet days can improve pheasant numbers in your area. And that is our phenology for today about ringneck pheasants in Iowa. Theme music is from John Barleycorn Must Die by Traffic. And this is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio. Become a member or find the donate button at khoifm.org.
Without a little barley cold.
This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation in Story County. Information can be found at oasco.org, oasco.org.
I love spring if I've never known winter, the cold gray dawn, the chills, the bone. Wood frozen like stone, first cracks, then splinters, surrendering to the dark grace of winter. Summer's bright and easy days, low lake light, bees buzzing waves, harvest plenty, leaves red and gold, another year is growing old.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I have been your host for today, Susan Franzen. Other voices you heard were Linda Merkin, Pat Schlarbaum, Irv Kloss, and Lucas Bliley. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards, from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was One More Circle Round the Sun by Peter Mayer from the CD Million Year Mind, and The Dark Grace of Winter, from the CD Hummingbird by Susan Osborne. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.